Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's program. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, you can draw inspiration from Saint Bonaventure of Bagnoregio and his Tree of Life.
And from All Things Carmelite with our popular Latin lover. The 16th of July is the day the Church celebrates the Feast of Our Lady of Mount Carmel. So why not take the time to find out more about All Things Carmelite with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster. Father Foster, you're a Carmelite, right?
A Carmelita.
Carmel is a prominent landmark in northern Israel, at a remote and inaccessible height. Is that right?
It's a Mount Carmel. It's a mountain over Haifa, overlooking Haifa.
First part of the word, it comes from the Hebrew, no? A word meaning vineyard or a garden.
Yeah, of gardens.
And the suffix El takes on the meaning of garden of the Lord, but in Hebrew. So how would you say all that in Latin?
Suffixum arcipit vim ex lingua hebraica, vim divinam.
Vim.
El, vim, power, force.
Is that why the soap used to be called vim?
Well, certainly. What you wash your bathroom with is... Or when someone has vim and vigor. Those are two Latin words just right there.
You're connected to Elijah.
Yeah, he's considered our spiritual father. Well, if you go to St. Peter's Basilica, you have a massive statue of Elias.
Where?
In the main aisle of St. Peter's.
I've never seen it.
Well, you should, on the right-hand side.
On his chariot.
No, he's not. He's standing there. And it's really there. It's a Omnium Carmelitarum Pater, the father of all Carmelites.
He was pursued into the desert by his enemies, and after a 40-day journey, he was left in the depths of failure, loneliness, and despair.
Oh, yeah, well, that wasn't why he's the Carmel with the Carmelites.
So what's he got to do with Carmelites?
Because what they call the duplicem spiritum. He had a double spirit, which I like about the Carmelites to this day.
What does that
mean?
Namely,
when I go home now, I'm a hermit. No one comes in, no one bothers, no noise, no nothing.
How do you say that?
But when I'm outside, I'm very active and busy.
Okay, can you say all that to me in Latin?
Paucis verbis. Bene, cum domi sum tamquam anacoretusum. Sed foris cum versor sum actuosissimus. I'm very active when I'm outside. But I like the idea to turn the thing on and off, you see. I mean, I can run around all day long. When I go home, bang, that's the end of it. Silence, peace, prayer, meditation, and that's the double spirit. I mean, some people turn their rooms or their monasteries into like meeting halls. Oh, no.
How would you describe your charism in a few words in Latin?
Well, it's a duplex spiritus. It's a precationis et actionis of prayer and activity.
Chiefly contemplative, involving enclosure and withdrawal from the world.
Certim est umbratilis vel contemplativa vita. Bene, certissime clausuram amplectens et recessum amundo.
But some Carmelites actually live enclosed, don't they? They're cloistered Carmelites.
Oh, yeah, the sisters are.
Just the sisters?
Yeah, we don't have... Well, no. Well, we have what you call desert foundations.
Which are?
Like, you know, hermits. We have one in the United States in West Virginia, where they have little houses and there are five or six. And
that's not being a hermit, being five or six together.
No, I mean, they're living five or six are in five, six little houses. So we still have it, but it's the sisters who have the strict enclosure, which we don't. We don't have.
Would the Romans have understood that kind of life, the life of a hermit?
No, they probably wouldn't have understood it. There were such people, like philosophers and stuff, you know, who would go off and be alone and run away from humanity in this wicked world and then come back and maybe teach and do something and then disappear. The Romans knew that people did this. But they wouldn't understand, religiously they wouldn't understand.
But do you think Cicero would have understood Elijah at all?
Yes, I think so.
when he was on his chariot of fire, or what?
Chariot of fire.
How do you say chariot of fire?
Kuros igneus. That's in scripture.
Anyway, getting back to Cicero, do you think he would have understood Elijah, or?
He would have understood like a double way of life. I mean, which he himself did. I mean, he would be in the forum and in the Senate House giving speeches, and then maybe for a couple months nothing, and writing things at home in silence in the library. Well, they understood, you know, the switching on and off.
So how do you say a switch? How would you say
permutatio, commutatio?
Anyway, switching to other Carmelite figures in the 16th century. A Spanish mystic called St. Teresa of Avila.
Well, she's our foundress, the Legifera Mater, the legislating mother. Of course, founded the nuns, and then she got some men to follow her idea.
Like St. John of the Cross.
Mm-hmm.
She was described as a restless, contumacious gadabout at one point.
Well, yes.
How do you say all that in Latin?
Inquieta... Et impudens vagabunda. Well, because she was running around Spain making foundations and all that stuff. And was involved in everything, writing to kings and queens and popes. And so she was quite...
It was the Carmelite double life she actually had.
And then she'd come home and get off her jackass and become in the monastery and quiet and not do anything for a year.
What are other figures that you think are particularly significant for the Carmelites?
I mean, we have all of our giants there, Thérèse
of Lisieux.
Yes.
The other Thérèse, and then Edith Stein more recently.
Yeah, the latest. Yeah.
And what's the name? Titus Brandsman.
Well, he's the other order. I mean, he's a Carmelite,
okay,
too.
Okay, we got that. He's not a Descalz Carmelite? Or
no, he's a Kelts Carmelite.
So you're a Descalz Carmelite,
yes,
but you have shoes on.
Yes, that's all gone. The name doesn't mean anything anymore. In the old days, in the 1500s, to be with unshod, got it, like sandals or barefoot, was a sign of a reform, that the order was reformed, and we belong to the reformation of the order.
A sign of poverty.
Well, it was a sign. It was an exterior sign. That's why you have Descalz Augustinians. And all these people with sandals were supposed to be a sign of a reformed, this is the Council of Trent business, a reformed order. But anyway, now Descalz doesn't mean anything in English.
Of course, you have a Marian devotion too, which we haven't spoken about.
Well, yes, certainly.
Our Lady of Mount Carmel.
Oh, yeah, that goes way back to the beginning.
What can you tell me about it?
Well, I mean, that's why the old thing in the Old Testament, where they saw this little, like a cloud over Mount Carmel, and they always interpreted this as the presence of the Blessed Mother and so forth and so on. But as soon, they had this devotion to Mary. And when they came to Europe from Mount Carmel, they brought this tremendous devotion to Mary.
But why are you talking about the Old Testament?
Well, I mean, that's where the thing started. And they said this figure of the cloud and then the rain coming down, you know, after...
Can you explain all that to me in Latin?
No, right now.
Oh, come on,
no.
You can.
No.
Yes, you can.
Ec omnia explicantur. Beh, said like nubes erat figura Virginis Mariae. The cloud erat figura, the form of Virginis Mariae. Cuius cultum Carmelite in Europam transtulerum. They brought it over into Europe. Very, very much from the beginning. El Rivera, really, down to it, nos vocamur fratres Carmelitane Beatissime Virginis Maria, the brothers of the Blessed Virgin Mary, is our official title from the 1200s.
But in the Ancient Testament,
No, I understand, but all these figures, and then the new, let's say the Christians in the New Testament, were looking for figures and predictions in the Old Testament, and found all these things. And one of them was the famous cloud there, Elias, and it was raining, and it rained, and so forth and so on. And they said this was a figure of the Blessed Virgin. But they were dedicated to her from the beginning. As I say, we are called Brothers of the Blessed Virgin Mary of Mount Carmel. That's our official title in the Annuario Pontificio.
So your initials are?
Well, now I know. OCD.
OCD.
Carmelitatum Discalciatorum.
Are there any fathers of the church who wrote about Elijah in a special
way? Oh, heaven's sakes, they all did.
And heartfelt thanks there to our friend Carmelite Reginald Foster, and a happy feast day to him. I'd never noticed it before, but the feast of St. Bonaventure falls on the 15th of July, the eve of the day the church remembers Our Lady of Mount Carmel, so an occasion to find out more about him.
Bonaventure, a saint from the Middle Ages. One especially dear to Pope Benedict XVI, and indeed the focus of his habilitation, the degree that qualifies a person to hold a chair at a German university, obtained by writing a scholarly book, a choice which he himself describes in his memoirs, which end for the record in 1977, in the following way. Quote, "Since I had done work on Augustine, it seemed natural for me to work on Bonaventure." Unquote. A choice which would have its ups and downs, the most humorous of which, perhaps with hindsight, was the practical side to things. Quote, "By the end of the summer semester of 1955, the handwritten manuscript was ready. Unfortunately, I hit upon a typist who was not only slow, but who now and then also lost pages and taxed my nerves to the utmost by committing all manner of errors, particularly in connection with the page numbers in the references. The battle to discover and correct all the mistakes was endless." Unquote.
Well, having offered you this aside with an insight into the more human side to the then young Father Ratzinger, I'd now like to move on in my intent of finding out more about St. Bonaventure. This man who I knew was formed in the shadow of St. Francis. Living out the spirit of poverty and authentic love taught by this more popular saint. What was, I thought to myself, so special about this so-called seraphic doctor? And what exactly was his link to St. Francis, anyway? So I turned to a Franciscan from the Order of Friars Minor, who teaches Franciscan spirituality, in an effort to better understand. He put it in a nutshell for me. Let's listen.
What Francis did in the world, Bonaventure wrote up for us.
Like Pope Benedict, Father Rick Martignetti knows Saint Bonaventure well, having created a study of one of this saint's most poetic texts, by the inspiring title of The Tree of Life, a study in which he uses words such as fruits and roots, but more often obscure expressions such as coincidence of opposites, not really the average person's idea of bedside reading. I pondered how could I possibly coax Father Rick to break away from this erudite text, turn Bonaventure the scholar into a friendly saint for the people of today, one who could reach out to them in a meaningful way. I tried hard to unshackle his patience, but he was game enough, in turn inviting me to unshackle my imagination.
Help
helping me pick up the heartbeat of this man from the 13th century. To begin with, I chose to ride a familiar wave, that of creation and St. Francis. A lot of people think of St. Francis as being close to creation in general. What about St. Bonaventure?
He himself was fascinated by nature and by creation. It's like he presented on paper kind of what Francis did. So we have one of his works, for example, is The Soul's Journey into God. And it's a way of us, normal people, average people, getting closer to God through meditation, like Francis did. And one of the things Bonaventure proposes in that work is meditation on creation. He says we can meditate on anything that God has made, and that meditation can lead us to appreciate the beauty of the Creator. So he was fascinated by beauty, and there's a Swiss theologian, Balthasar, who says that Bonaventure probably talks about beauty more than any other theologian. Fascinated in letting the beauty of creation lead us to appreciate the beauty of the Creator. And of course, from that, we come to the beauty of Jesus Christ, which really enthralled Bonaventure. But to appreciate the beauty of Jesus Christ, you need to look a little deeper.
So I asked, thinking back to my bedside reading, what would looking even deeper mean exactly? I wasn't ready for the reply.
Bonaventure would look to the cross of Christ and say, at first, it's repulsive. You know, at first, the cross is just an instrument of torture and death and human suffering. But if we look deeper, we see the love that made the cross happen. We see the love that sent our God to the earth and that kept our God true to us, even though it meant death on the cross. Jesus' sacrifice is a great act of love and not giving up on us. And Bonaventure felt that if we sat before the cross and meditated on the cross long enough, we'd see past the pain and see through to the love. That's what he felt was the experience of Francis, who at the end of his life actually received the sacred stigmata. Francis received the five wounds in his hands, his feet, and in his side that Jesus had received on the cross, because Francis wanted to experience the same love that Christ had experienced for us. And he came to see that that would happen through the pains and sufferings of the cross.
From the beauty of creation to the cross, that was one great leap. At this point, I felt I needed to touch base once again, going back to one of the reasons I got interested in St. Bonaventure in the first place, Pope Benedict's fascination with him. In my rather blunt manner, I asked Father Rick why he thought that was, thinking it might provide me with a key to the understanding of this medieval saint.
I think one of the reasons Bonaventure is fascinating, and one of the reasons Pope Benedict probably found him so fascinating, is for Bonaventure, the way to wisdom is through holiness. Sometimes in our modern days, we think we can do theology as only an intellectual exercise, that it can be something separate from our relationship with God. And for Bonaventure, that would have been a completely foreign concept. You can't learn about God intellectually unless you experience God in your heart. So Bonaventure says, we can get to wisdom, we can discover the truths about God, but we need to get there through holiness. And holiness means having a relationship with Jesus Christ, falling in love with Jesus Christ, living his doctrine. Then we come to appreciate the truths of who God is. Sometimes in our modern day, we think that can be separated, that you can have an intellectual knowledge of God without an experiential knowledge of God. And for Bonaventure, that was just not possible. And I think that's one of the attractions that the Pope has for him. He knew that we needed a relationship with Christ to understand truth and wisdom.
Deeper and deeper. So I asked, how about an image to illustrate Bonaventure?
Another image that's been suggested, again, by Balthasar, the Swiss theologian, is when we stand before a work of art. We can look at it, how it was made. You can look at the frame. You can look at the brush strokes. You can analyze the art of the period. And that's all well and good. But to really appreciate the beauty of a work of art, you need to let yourself be carried outside of yourself. You need to be lifted up in awe at the beauty that's before you. That's when you really appreciate it, and that's when you really have an understanding of what the art is. And as Balthasar points out, that was Bonaventure's experience of Jesus. It wasn't just an intellectual, heady experience. He let himself be carried out of himself in awe, in love at just how wonderful Jesus Christ really is and what Christ did for us. And that's what he tried to capture, and that's what he tried to put on paper, to lead us as well into that type of relationship with Jesus. So Bonaventure proposes that we can all enter into a mystical journey that gets us closer and closer to Christ if we let ourselves fall in love with Jesus.
He's often called the Prince of the Mystics, Bonaventure, isn't he? What is a mystic exactly?
There's different schools of thought as to what a mystic is. One of the best definitions I like is that a mystic is just a person who lives with a constant awareness of God. Just knowing that God is present in every moment and doing everything for God and with God. So that the writer can write with God, and the singer sings with God, and the preacher preaches with God. And a mystic, I think someone like Bonaventure, teaches us to just make God part of everything. And that's the secret of getting closer to God, just calling to mind God's presence in our daily lives, no matter what we're doing. I think one of the things Bonaventure has to offer us today is that he calls us to a greater dependence on God, to know our God personally and to engage our God as a loving friend. Bonaventure talks about prayer so often. He depended on prayer. He looked at St. Francis and saw that St. Francis had become a prayer himself, doing everything with and for God. And, you know, Bonaventure challenges theologians who try to do theology without prayer. He calls the friars and the sisters who had consecrated themselves as religious, and he challenges them, saying, a religious who doesn't pray carries around a dead soul in a living body. That's how firm he was about it. Prayer was everything to him. And prayer is just a way of, you know, casting all our concerns on the Lord and letting the Lord get us through everything.
How many people today know how to pray?
Prayer can be learned. I think today people are afraid. They think, I don't know how to pray, and they leave it at that. But it can be learned. There's so many different techniques of prayer. One of the ones that Bonaventure proposes in his work, The Tree of Life, is to use your imagination. You know, the imagination is a wonderful gift that we think it's only for children, but it's not. Adults can use their imagination to make themselves present with Christ again. You know, to pick up a text from the Bible, for example, Jesus at the Last Supper, and to close your eyes, use your imagination, and imagine yourself sitting right beside Jesus at the Last Supper. What would that be like? What would that feel like? What would be the sounds and the sights you might experience being at the Last Supper? What would it be if Jesus broke off a piece of bread, handed it to you personally, and said, "This is my body"? What would you do? In the Tree of Life, Bonaventure proposes a lot of scenarios like that, of us entering into the scripture passage, not just reading it, but becoming part of it ourselves. And that's just one of the many ways that we can pray and get to know Jesus in a more intimate, personal way.
Anything about Bonaventure that brings him a bit more down to earth?
Bonaventure was so busy with the Franciscans and with his pastoral ministry. But the church saw the beauty of what he was doing, and popes were calling on him to help out with church teaching, help out at ecumenical councils. And he was kind of torn between all these opportunities. And they tried to make him a bishop early on, and he prevailed upon the pope not to force him, and he was able to turn down being Bishop of York. Later on in his life, though, they came a second time to make him a cardinal. And the story is told that when the papal delegates went to the friary where he was with the cardinal hat to present him with this new honor, he was there washing the dishes at the sink with the friars. And he just told the delegate, "I'll get to it in a minute. I just have to finish these dishes." And it's just kind of a nice story that tells you about his down-to-earth humility, not one to get puffed up by honors, but one who knew that being a leader in the church was all about service.
You were listening there to Father Rick Martignetti of the Order of Friars Minor, author of a book by the title of St. Bonaventure's Tree of Life. That brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Laudetur Jesus Christus.